welcome to Everybody A Vander Jesus Gay.
Yay! A queer exploration of our Vander Jesus.
With your hosts, Speak Pirate, aka Joanna. I'm here, I'm queer, and I have a cat named Spencer.
And your other host, LCO123, aka Vina, and do I even have to say it? We get to talk about my Lord and Savior tonight. It's the Vander Jesus episode, everybody.
It has been a long time coming. We are devoting all of our energies tonight to talking about one Mona Vanderwall, aka Vander Jesus, aka, you know, the best A, aka the queen of our hearts.
Yes. And I mean, it's a great time to talk about her. Obviously, we're at the end of the series. And so it's a good time to do a lot of bonus things. But especially we voiced a lot of criticism and concern about the way that Mona's story arc is, you know, is wrapped up on the show. And it just seemed like, you know, a great time to kind of talk about the things we love about this character. And I think I've gone on record and said that Mona is my favorite character in all of PLL. And maybe we can just start and say, like, what do we love about Mona? What sets her apart from the other characters on this show?
Well, I think that you always love somebody who's like a little bit of an outsider. And Mona has that outsider energy, but she also has this, like, if you love the Liars, you have to love Mona because Mona is a mirror of each of them, you know? Mm-hmm. So I think, like, and Mona's, like, desires are very relatable, like wanting this inclusion with the Liars. You understand why she wants it. Mona always being so in love with Hannah. Like, we're in love with Hannah, too, as the viewer. Like,
yeah.
It's sort of like on a reality show, like on, you know, a Housewives franchise or something. You have to have, like, the messy, you know, the messy people who, like, bring all the drama. But you also have to have, like, the observer character who
yeah.
allows, like, an access point for the viewer. You have to have, like, a Heather Gay as well as a Lisa Barlow for anyone who watches Salt Lake City. Like, you have to have both. And I think that, like, in some ways, Mona is sort of this access point for yeah. the viewers.
Yeah, I would say for, you know, like for Drag Race fans, like, she's kind of like the Katya. Like, she's kind of she's this access point. She's sort of the character within the show who is watching the show of PLL. She's the observer, and yet she's also like the instigator. And I think that there is something very specifically queer about being the observer, because queer people often learn at a pretty young age how to read everybody around them, sometimes, you know, in search of community, sometimes in search of protection. And Mona just sort of like drifts through these different personalities in a way that I think feels very queer. And I think the way that her desire, it's all feels so complicated. It's sort of the eternal, you know, do I want to be her or do I want to be with her? It's just so much wrapped up in there that I think make her a great character, and specifically make her a great character to a queer audience.
I definitely, definitely agree with that. Also, I think that, like, Mona's character, more so, even than a lot of the Liars themselves, like, Mona's character in the first two seasons is the most intentional thing that the show ever does. Like, mm-hmm, making mm-hmm. Mona have all of these layers, like, giving,
yes.
you know, giving Mona her, like, you know, kind of Clark Kent personality and also her, like, secret A personality. A lot of work and effort goes into that. And I feel like it's an investment that the show makes in the character that continues
yeah.
to pay off, like, down the years. Like, Mona is in a lot of ways the only plot device that ever works. Like, you could have Mona Vanderwall walk into any scene in any circumstance and say anything, and I would buy it. Like, Mona could come in
yes.
and be like, well, I've got the nuclear launch codes. And I'd be like, oh, that Mona, of course she does. Or like,
yeah,
you know, Mona could like come in and be like, you know, rushing in like, well, I just stole this $25,000 handbag from, you know, Yvonne on the street. Help me with this caper. Like, and it would be like, oh, that's also so Mona. So like, really, I feel like it helps the show to have a character who we would just believe she's capable of absolutely anything.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. She's really like the best thing that the show ever did in a lot of ways. She's complicated and smart and stylish and funny and one step ahead of everybody. And I also think that she's really sort of the nucleus of a lot of the show's great identity work. You know, she remade Hannah and Allie's image. You know, Allie, who in turn based her persona on Cece, a persona that was specifically crafted to appeal to Allison. And Mona is kind of at the heart of all of that. She also sort of shares a lot with Spencer. She shares a lot with Emily. She doesn't have to be, you know, quote unquote, good in the way that the liars often do. And yet her single like vulnerability is the woman that she loves. It's like she's this character who wishes she could cut off her humanity and her emotions, but she can't. She loves her dolls and she loves them in this way that feels just strange and specific and twisted. You know, she wants to torment them, but to take care of them. She wants to give them what they really want, but not the way that they think that they want it. She's so complex.
She is so complex. And for a show that gives a redemption arc to any loser man who like walks across a camera frame anytime, Mona's redemption arc is like so complicated that I think that's another element that really like, as a queer audience, we really want to root for her. Like, we really want to root for her to win. We really want to root for her to be redeemed. We want to root for the liars to eventually, like, give her, you know, give her the trust and the confidence that we feel like she so richly deserves.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I know that when we talked about, when we did our Taylor Swift episode and we talked about the songs, specifically of Midnights that went with the different liars, I talked about the song Mastermind, but I just have to read this one section from that song again, because I think it sums up Mona and why we love Mona and why we sort of ache for Mona so specifically. And the section is, "No one wanted to play with me as a little kid, so I've been scheming like a criminal ever since to make them love me and make it seem effortless. This is the first time I felt the need to confess, and I swear I'm only cryptic and Machiavellian because I care." That's Mona.
It's so Mona. There's so, oh my gosh, yes. It is Mona to a T.
Yeah, she's also just like, she's funny, she's cunning, she cuts through all the bullshit. I just like, how do you not love Mona? She's just a delight.
She is. She and especially like having just gone through like the, you know, basically like the Russian winter of the time jump period. Yeah. Like, she just elevates every scene that she's in, every episode that she's in is like better. Is much better for the presence of Mona. And I, when you talk about, like, we've already opened a couple different, like, channels of things that I'd like to get into with Mona. You talked about the identity work that the show does and how Mona is really kind of at the heart of that. Mm-hmm. And one thing that we've talked about a lot in general, and a thing that we come back to, is Mona kind of creating Allie, like creating Hannah in the image of Allie, transforming Hannah into Allison. And I think that one thing that it's really interesting to keep an eye on is that in so many ways, what Mona is doing there is dazzle camouflage. She is physically helping Hannah to transform, you know, to do this like ugly duckling into the swan narrative of Hannah becoming the physical embodiment of Allison. But Mona really takes over Allison's like emotional blackmail business.
Yeah.
You know, like, mm-hmm. she never like changes who Hannah is inside. She makes Hannah into Allison, but Hannah is always like this like inherently nicer version of Allison. So it's Mona who is like still throwing Allison's old insults around in the hallways, and Mona who is like using fear to kind of keep like the other students in line.
Yeah, I completely agree. And there's also this really interesting thing of Mona sort of creating a version of Allison that could love her in Hannah.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know?
100%.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Man, do you want to, gosh, there's so many places we could go. This character has so much to talk about. Do you want to talk about some of like our favorite Mona moments, or do you have more stuff you want to talk about before we get there?
You know, I will say one thing, because I think that when we get to like our Mona moments and stuff, I think we'll have a lot that kind of tie back into this. One question that I want to talk about is, why is Mona's queerness subtextual?
Oh, that's such a good question. I think in a way, much in the way that Hannah doesn't really want to look at it, I think that the show doesn't really want to look at it, because I think to look at it would be almost to give it more power than the show feels comfortable doing. I also think that Mona evolved as this character who was almost more complex than I think perhaps previously intended in some ways. And I think that she, like, they maybe didn't even know how to approach it, how to sort of wrap their arms around the subject of Mona as a queer person, like that it's not her queerness that makes her quote unquote bad, but it's all connected. It's all like tangled up, like, you know, like a big bowl of spaghetti. I don't know. I feel like had the show addressed it more, no pun intended, straightforwardly, I'm not sure that they would have done a great job. But it also is endlessly frustrating that her queerness is always hinted at. What's your take?
Well, I was just really thinking about this as we were getting ready for this episode, because it's within the first couple episodes, like we're still getting to know all the characters when they give Mona the no homo, when she's talking to Hannah.
Yeah.
And she's saying, like, I mean, you know, I don't mean this in a gay way, but I totally would bang you in that dress. Like,
yeah,
I'm paraphrasing there, obviously, but like, so they're making explicit, like Mona is saying, I would bang you in that dress, but she's also saying, but like, you know,
but like,
I were, you know,
but like right. not in a gay way.
right.
Yeah.
Like, so they give, like, they put it there. And then they play like a little shell game with it. And I feel like we see that again when Mona is with Mike. And so then there's all this, like, you know, they want to give her some heterodrama, even though Mike, I mean, really reads like a beard, I feel like, for, you know, they really seem to be like friends who are, you know,
both figuring each other out. Yeah.
And also, when I think about, like, Mona, and particularly, like, Mona as, like, the Mona of the first two seasons, where Mona is A, and where, you know, we get, like, the big confrontation at Lookout Point and everything like that, like, you know, Marlene is, like, not that far off where I am in age, and, like, growing up, like, there were, like, so many movies that were, like, you know, The Crush or Poison Ivy, where like this was like a frequent plot trope, like, you know a good girl becomes obsessed with the bad girl, very much in the way that like Mona becomes obsessed with Allison, or Mona becomes obsessed with the Liars, and then, you know, chaos you know, chaos ensues because of this infatuation. And I just feel like that's definitely a story that Marlene has like seen and possibly even told before. So it's interesting that it happens here, but that like in those movies, like that were from an earlier era, like they do, you know, like, oh, the characters might have sleepovers in the same bed and sure there might be some kissing, but it's not, you know, not no homo, not in a gay way. It's just, I think it's interesting to see like Mona as a continuation of that.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it makes me also think of, you know, true love, honey, just can't kill it.
Yep.
Yeah. 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 It is this unspoken thing. And I think it's sort of this, it's like, you know, like a whistle that only gay people can hear kind of thing where like, I guess that there are straight people who watch this show and don't see Mona as queer, which is, doesn't make any sense to me, but I'm sure they're out there. But like for a queer audience, Mona is so, I think, like deeply relatable and identifiable as a queer character. Yeah. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. There's just no question about it.
I mean, she tries to kiss Hannah on the ghost train.
Yes, she does. Yes, she does. Yeah. Yeah. So should we talk about, I have a lot of favorite moments. I will.
Yes. Yes. Let's go.
Okay. Do you want me to run through my list or should we go back and forth? How do you want to
think? Well, I think your list is very comprehensive. So I think we should run through your list. And then I have a couple that I will also mention.
Okay. So I tried to do this somewhat chronologically. We'll see how we go. You know, some of the later season stuff gets a little muddy. So I took note of like some of my favorite Mona moments and lines, when this is, I believe in season one, maybe early season two, when the Liars are having the fashion show and Mona is, you know, directing traffic and says to Aria, are your legs always that short? Which is such a funny moment because Mona and Aria are like the same height. I think that's an amazing moment. Of course, Camp Mona is instant classic, you know, Mona running camp and finding time to run over her best friend. So great. During the truth up day when she says, oh, honey, that was like two personalities ago and that her whole scheming plan with Emily to Spencer, you're smart, smart. I thought you were just book smart. The entirety of Unmasked, that episode is so incredible. When Mona is in Radley and on drugs and she talks about how, you know, she's done a lot of things and she's had to forgive herself for a lot of that, you know, the very creepy scene of her singing the Teddy Bear's Picnic on the Halloween train. And then, of course, as you mentioned, her almost kissing Hannah, the whole sequence during Spencer's sort of torment in season three when she tells Spencer, you're just as sane as I am. I don't think this made my initial list, but of course, the incredible quiz off scene is just so good. I really loved you once and I really was your friend. What a line. And then, you know, possibly my favorite Mona moment, which is her hypnotizing Hannah into thinking she killed Wilden, then going and confessing to the murder herself. Mona and Aria in No One Here Can Love or Understand Me, when she asks in just that heartbreaking way, do you think Mike really likes me? Mona in Shadow Play announcing that was the last carrot stick. Mona and Allie's lost weekend in A is for Answers, where they definitely hooked up. The episode where we meet Leona, Mona's mom, and all of the interactions between them. After we think that Mona has died and she and Hannah have all those flashbacks of reading Poe and Mona explaining how she would have a stopwatch and then sort of predicting her own future by talking about Allie getting locked up in Radley. Mona transforming Hannah into Allie and then that spectacularly queer walk down the hallway where that girls, girls, girls song is playing. Mona in the dollhouse as Allison, and then when she breaks the facade and makes it clear that she does know that she's Mona, After the liars have come back from the dollhouse and Mona commands and, you know, charms all of the animals at the lab to go back into their cages. Mona at Hannah's wedding shower talking about good intentions ending up as trash. Mona covering for the liars in Hit and Run, Run, Run by replacing the windshield after the Rollins Hit and Run, Run, Run. Mona sweeping in to save Hannah's fashion business with that young influencer who she definitely was hooking up with. Mona going back into the game to save Allison. The jailhouse rock sequence. Even though I do not like that Mona is the one who kills Charlotte, I do like that Mona defends the liars from Charlotte. And then, you know, that heartbreaking line that she has to Hannah, "You needed me, you don't know how good that felt." So those are some of my, just in a quick nutshell, you know, top of the brain, some of my favorite goodness. Mona moments.
I mean, that is an extremely, extremely extensive list. And a lot of the moments that I have are like from the same episodes that you have things from, just because, I mean, Mona is just that fantastic. Oh. From the episode where she and Emily are getting up to the caper during the truth up day, my favorite Mona moment from that is when she asks Emily what she should wear to a swim meet. That's like, because like she's like saying that she's gonna come and support Emily, and also like fashion is sort of like Mona's love language, and so like you know, I really enjoy that moment between them. Also, one of my all-time favorite Mona moments, and I'm so glad that this is one that you did not have on your list, because your list was so comprehensive, but when she's in the cafeteria and she's sitting at a table alone unwrapping her own A-threat, so the liars will, like, see it, and then...
Yep!
Like, amazing. Oh my gosh. And it's like, she's peeling an apple or something, like the apple has a threat inside of it, so she's like literally peeling back layers that she has like set up herself. I love that as my like kind of indelible image of Mona. From the episode where she is helping Hannah to like confess to the murder of Wilden, and then of course Mona's gonna go and do it herself. There's a line in that episode when she kind of tells Hannah, like, "Careful, it's been a long time since I thought of you and me as an us," which is like, oh my gosh, it's such a, you know, ex-girlfriends type of line. Who are just about to get back together. So I love that. I love that for her. Of course, you mentioned the academic decathlon where she's like going head to head with Spencer. And like, I love the academic decathlon because she's doing it in her Mona face, but she's being just as manipulative as she ever was as A. And she's like pressing Spencer's buttons so effortlessly.
And it's very, she's flirting with Spencer in her A face. In a way that is really fascinating.
Yeah. So love that. And then I'm also going to say, like, I think that, like, I guess one through line of my favorite Mona moments is, like, the interplay of, like, her identity as A and her identity as Mona. And when she is as Mona, like, doing things that are, like, A moves. And one of the biggest ones of those is when she throws away Caleb's letter when he's about to go get on the bus. And she's just like, And I, you know, we think about Mona's A like in a nostalgic way as like the best A. And it's like the A that was like, you know, kind of a sadistic life coach, like sometimes giving the liars what they think they want, but in a way that's like, you know, just twisted enough that it's like, you know, careful what you wish for type things.
Yeah.
And I really think that, like, you know, Mona has access to hyper adrenalized reality. And, you know, we never get too specific within the show of like, what does that entail? But I mean, I'm going to say probably time travel. And Mona in that moment at like, whatever it was, the town bazaar, whatever situation that she was helping Hannah man that booth at. I think that Mona was like, you know what? I am going to save Hannah the bitter divorce that is coming 2 years after the series ends. Like, she was really looking out for her. She, you know, she knew the monster that Caleb was going to become and was like, I will spare you this if I can, my beloved.
Yes, she was looking into her Mona crystal ball and discovering it. And just, you know, you brought up the adrenalized hyperreality. And I love the lack of, like, it is somehow hyper-specific and completely non-specific in a way that I think is perfect. And I think is like, that's PLL at its finest.
Yeah. Yeah. And the other thing about Mona is that she interacts a lot with Hannah. She interacts, like, you know, throughout the series with all of the liars. And she also has interactions with non-liar characters that are really interesting. Like, her scene with Paige, when Paige asks her, like, when did you become the thing you were afraid of? Like, that's like a pivotal, like a thesis statement of PLL, really. And I love that she gets to have that moment with Paige, having that moment with another queer character who possibly recognizes, you know, something of themselves in Mona and in this journey that Mona is on.
Oh, maybe so. Maybe there could be something that perhaps is recognizable there.
And also you mentioned shadow play and the line about that was the last carrot stick. I really love, like, Mona's whole deal in shadow play. I mean, obviously we love the shadow play episode so much, but even that is very queer coded because, like, in a noir movie, like, she's playing the role that, like, Elizabeth Scott would get, you know, who was like blackballed from noir movies because of rumors that she was queer. So I really just, you know, I just feel like there is just so much about Mona that just reads as very queer and, like, very you know, like you were saying, like, is it like a dog whistle? Is it like, you know, it's not exactly queer baiting because it's like there's just so much to it. And then the show always just wants to kind of have plausible deniability about what they're doing there.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think that the shadow play example is an interesting one, too, because Hannah is also being kind of a little bit queer coded at that time period as well, as is Arya. You know, we talked about how, like, everybody is queer in Spencer's dream space, you know. I think that there's something just, really fascinating about, like, the times when it seems like Mona is allowed to express more queerness. And we've talked a lot about the ways in which it seems like Lucas sort of gets to express a level of queerness that Mona doesn't. What, like, how does that land for you? What do you make of that? And what do you make of the connection between Mona and Lucas?
Well, I think that Mona is a mirror for all of the characters. Like, that's kind of what gives Mona her power, I think, is that she's able to see them and kind of, like, reflect their own desires back onto them. Mm-hmm. So I think that, like, Lucas is the character who gets to be explicitly pining for Hannah, while Mona is the character who has to, like, you know, pine in a more silent way, in a way that is not, like, acknowledged in the same way that Lucas's feelings are. But we see Hannah kind of, we see Hannah react to them very similarly.
Yeah, and that with both characters, I think Hannah carries this measure of guilt and this measure of, like, not being able to quite look at the way that this person loves her, because to do that would just be too scary, I think.
And like, combined with that, I do think you're right. I do think that Hannah, like, you know, part of it is that Hannah doesn't have, like, you know, a ton of self-confidence in terms of, like, you know, her past and like, you know, she's always going to be someone who's, like, a little bit insecure on the inside, I think. However, she will like, you know, who knows? Maybe it's because Hannah's character, like, you know, she tells Spencer, like, I don't have lawyer parents who are going to, like, bail me out of anything that I get in trouble for. But Hannah accepts help from Lucas and Mona that would not be offered if they were not in love with her. Like, I don't really know that many people who would be like, oh, here, do you want to live rent-free in my giant apartment? Would you like to drive my silver Jag? Oh, can I, like, please go into this, like, psychological game space for you that I have, like, worked so hard to recover from mentally?
Yeah.
Like,
she accepts
help from both of those sources that only comes to her because they're in love with her, even if Hannah is never going to, like, acknowledge that or really deal with it in an out loud kind of way.
Similar to the way that similar, I think, in a sense, to the way that Allison is with Emily in the earlier seasons.
Yeah.
Really, really interesting. You know, I want to talk about sort of Mona's ending and Mona's future, but what are some other Mona things you'd like to talk about before we get there?
Well, I would like to talk about Mona as a mirror to the other liars, because I think we kind of just talked about that with Lucas. We talked a little bit about how she kind of, like, becomes, like, the mean parts of Allison, like the controlling the action parts of Allison, the blackmailing people parts of Allison. So we definitely see that. But, like, her storyline also mirrors Allison's. Like, you know, Allison came back from the dead. Mona, you know, intends to fake her own death and then return. And, you know, that doesn't go entirely according to plan. But, like, Mona also returns from the dead as the Vander Jesus and everything. So we kind of see that with Allison. What are the ways that you feel like, and of course, Emily, like, she kind of mirrors her queerness, and, like, Mona's affection for Hannah is, like, a mirror of what Emily felt for Allison.
Absolutely.
In a sort of somewhat straightforward and also somewhat twisted sort of way. But so, like, do you want to talk about ways that she's a mirror for Spencer or for Hannah herself or for Aria?
Yeah. I mean, I think that Mona and Spencer, they share, obviously, their intelligence, but they share this real need to be right, this need to win, this need to be the best, and this need to be, like, the smartest person in any room. I also think that they both share a lot of internalized homophobia that is rattling around for them. In terms of Aria, I think, you know, much in the way that Allison sort of admired the way that Aria lived so freely in the world, I think that Mona probably does too. I also think she's probably very annoyed by Aria, like, sees her as just, like, you know, God, if you would just, like, you know, wake up and, you know, figure this out. Like, it would, you know, you would, if you just, like, stop, you know, being with Prezra and just all these things, like, that kind of drives her nuts, that she probably sees Aria as sort of wasting her potential in a sense. And then, you know, in terms of Hannah, I think that they both have this hunger to be more than the way that they have often been perceived, to sort of up their status and change the perception that people have of, like, what they are each capable of.
Yeah, they could have been the girls who were holding everyone's purses, but then Mona changed their fates. I love that. I also think that with Spencer, like, they were both in Radley. They both have, you know, struggled with issues that brought them there.
For sure.
And with Aria, I feel like one of the things that Mona has in common with her, although it's expressed differently, is, like, when we think about Aria's rage, like, when we think about the Aria that, like, trashes Byron's office, or the Aria that, like, destroys Prezra's apartment, like, I think that Mona has that level of rage like constantly inside of her, but she really like channels it into her A schemes and like takes great pleasure in like creating that level of destruction and like helping Arya to access it.
Yeah, I think that that is really, really interesting because I do think that a thing that Mona does as A is, you know, when we talk about her sort of mirroring the other characters, I think part of that is like forcing them to behave more like her, you know, and to externalize the rage that she feels. Because like really, like the A persona allows Mona access to rage that I think she feels all the time. And so in a sense, there's a way in which being A, she's sort of in this very twisted, weird Mona way, trying to create the same space for the liars.
Yeah. Yeah, I totally agree.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, that's super interesting to think about.
All right. So let's see. What else did I have on my list? Yeah, I think let's go. You were going to say like Mona's kind of future. And...
Yeah. So first of all, I want to talk about why Mona's ending is not a happy ending. And, you know, we've talked a little bit about that in the last couple of episodes. I think, you know, it traps Mona in that endless dollhouse cycle by tying her to Alex and Mary as these captors. It never really allows her to be free. Just kind of keeps her on the hamster wheel of the game. And it sort of says that, like, the only way for her to win is for her to become a tormentor. And she is not allowed sort of personhood without the game. What else comes up for you when you think about Mona's ending as not being a happy ending?
Well, the thing that I think makes it not a happy ending, like pretty conclusively, in addition to all the things that you just mentioned, is that Mona, when she was operating in a healthy place, this isn't the ending that she would have wanted for herself. Like, absolutely. Mona didn't want to go back in on the game. Like, Mona was like, you know, Mona was like working pretty hard to like,
yes,
you know, kind of like manage those impulses. And so to see her, I feel like, and when she like talks to Hannah about the game and she says, it's like an addiction. Like,
yeah.
Mona's ending in it, like where Mona ends here is like equivalent to like, if we saw like, the last shot of Jason De Laurentiis was like him in a gutter with like a bottle of bourbon in his hand. It's like,
sure.
If the last thing that we saw of Spencer was her like taking a bunch of pills. Like that's the ending. That's the ending that we really see for Mona here.
Yeah. And it's not only trapping her emotionally, but it's trapping her physically as well. And she's like, what Mona always wanted was acceptance from the liars, and she couldn't be further from the liars in this particular ending. It's really, she's sort of falling down this well of her mental illness, and there's no bottom in sight.
Yeah, like winning the game for the other liars, it gets to mean freedom. It gets to mean that they can go on and they can live the rest of their lives. It shouldn't mean for Mona that she's just like trapped in an endless cycle of like, you know, reliving and recreating her trauma.
Yeah. And it's, I mean, you brought up that great Page quote earlier. Do you ever wonder when you became the thing that you're afraid of? I feel like Mona is like the living embodiment of that here at the end. It's sort of like the other like smaller stakes equivalent version of it would have been if like the series had ended when Allie came back and Mona like started up her army and was just like in defensive mode, you know, like this is not a glorious ending for the character. It's not triumphant in the way that it's portrayed as, you know, what would be triumphant for Mona is like growing and changing and, you know, being in therapy and having a partner who loves her unconditionally and a career that lets her be in charge and a good relationship with her mom and the liars finally appreciating her and, you know, getting to know that she was right about everything. Like, those would be a triumphant ending. Those would be triumphant endings for Mona, I feel.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. I 100,000% agree with that. I think that it's like, the other thing is that the show, it's similar to the way that the show wants us to like laugh when Sarah Harvey is killed in the shower. Like the show Sure. wants us to celebrate this ending for Mona. One of the things, like when we talk about Mona as a character, like when I said Mona is like the only plot device that ever worked, like she could come in and say anything and I would believe her. Mona is like in this world that is like very campy, and in this world where Mona has this imaginary superpower of hyperadrenalized reality, like the one thing that is consistent about Mona is that like Janelle always plays her as a real person. And so this is like saying that like the face of the real person doesn't exist, and like only like the only thing that's there is the supervillain. And I just don't think that that's true. And it consistently throughout the series has driven me wild that like no matter how much Mona helps the liars, no matter how many times she like goes to the mat for them and like puts herself on the line and is like operating in a very like come on you guys, it's obvious she's trying to help you, it's obvious she's on your side now, get it together, the liars consistently react towards her with like suspicion and distrust, and Caleb has like a seething hatred of her as the series moves along. And I hate that this ending kind of says like, oh look, they were right. Yeah. She can never truly be reformed. And so I don't like that at all. I don't like that as like a, you know, kind of an 11th hour justification for all of their bad behaviors.
I totally agree. It's a very weird situation. Like it's the show is never really sure, much in the way that it treats Allie. The show is never really sure if, like, we're on Mona's side or not. And this ending is bizarre because they're trying to kind of have both sides of it. They're trying to have us agree with, you know, Caleb and Ashley and the non-Hannah liars for telling Hannah the whole episode, like, Mona is the devil. But they're also trying to kind of have us cheer Mona on at the end. And it's also a symptom of, like, not doing a good enough job of making Alex Drake a character and barely doing any kind of job of making Mary Drake a character, because it's, like, this doesn't, like, it just doesn't work on any of these levels. And it's, I think maybe we're meant to see it as, like, well, this is better than, you know, Charlotte, who had Mona down in the hole in her dollhouse. But it's still, like, it's still a really grim ending for this character.
You bring up a great point about Alex Drake and Mary Drake, because one of the things, it's like very easy for us to understand why the dollhouse is a really fucked up situation, because we understand the liars are like individual people and not dolls. You really can't say that about the characters of Alex Drake and Mary Drake. Like, they are not three-dimensional in the same way. They're not characters that we have like experienced any investment in. So it actually like doesn't feel like it doesn't really feel the same way to like, you know, have them be trapped as dolls by Mona at the end.
Yeah, it's very much a moment of like, what are we meant to be thinking here? How are we meant to be taking this?
Yeah. I definitely agree.
It's weird. So maybe we can talk about something a little nicer, which is like, who do we ship Mona with? And I'm just going to say, first of all, I want to just say, we've talked about this somewhat. Mona is a character that I headcanon as a lesbian. I feel that all of her relationships with men are either transactional or based on friendship, and that all of her sort of interest in men feels very performative to me. And it seems to me that the only characters that she like truly seems to feel romantic intention toward in a like true, genuine way are women. So I feel that Mona is a lesbian character, and thank you for coming to my TED Talk.
Yeah, I don't disagree with you. also, I feel like when you look at the men that she's dated for like the longest period of time on the show, we have Mike Montgomery and we have Noel Kahn, exclamation point.
Yes.
Who we also feel might have been involved with each other. Yeah. So like, I feel like it says something. You know, I guess aside from Holden, she gets yeah. like to, I Holden and Sean, like I guess she really does date two of the like kind of queer coded guys on the show.
Yes, absolutely. So I want to hear who you ship Mona Vanderwaal with.
Okay. I mean, I feel like we're almost going to do like a family feud of like, you know, the top answers as we reveal them. I'm sure we're going to have many of the same ones. Well, Vandermeeren is a top choice.
Yes.
Because that is what Mona wants. And I want Mona to have everything that she wants. So even though it's really complicated, even though it's really messy, I do have to say that, like, you know, Vandermeeren in my heart, because I think that Mona should get to have what she wants. Hannah should get a partner who like respects her and understands her. I think that Hannah as a character, we see Hannah's love for Mona. We see mm-hmm, it throughout mm-hmm. the show. Hannah has to hide it from her friends a lot of time, how important yeah. Mona is to her. And Hannah goes and visits her in Ravelry in secret, even after she understands that Mona was A. Like, she mm-hmm. she's still going there. She's doing her makeup. She's, you know, like, when we think that Mona is dead, Hannah goes through that whole period of being a grieving widow. And, like, in those moments, Hannah's feelings for Mona seem much more straightforward because, like, in death, Mona, who's, like, extremely complicated in life, like, you know, Hannah can reduce her to one thing, like, a person she loves and misses. So I feel like, and when we get to that, like, it's one of the only interesting things about the last half season. We get to the moment where Hannah goes to Mona and says, "You're the only person who can win this. I need you to help me."
Yeah.
It's this moment of Hannah who, like, sees so much of who Mona is, who sees, like, perhaps a more, like, holistic view of Mona than anyone else in the universe of PLL. And Hannah, who, like, has never been able to, like, directly look at or directly address all of this, she, like, says to Mona, like, I need the part of you that is A to help me. And, like, the thing that Hannah isn't saying is, like, and I know you're gonna do this because I know that you love me. Like, I feel like there's so much yeah. to that. And so for all those reasons, I think my number one answer here is Vandermeeren.
So I completely agree with all of that. My question to you is, and maybe we can talk about this, what would need to happen to make this work? How would Hannah need to evolve? Like, because there are some roadblocks, I think. And I think, you know, I think one of them is like Hannah's just refusal to really, really look at this straight, no pun intended, straight on. And is it simply getting through this divorce? Because I do think Hannah getting through the divorce of Caleb would be really a helpful, an illuminating and helpful time for her.
I definitely agree with that. Okay, so what would have to happen for Vandermeeren to really work? So Hannah has always struggled with her own identity. And mm-hmm. I think that Hannah would have to, like, continue to sort of work on that so that, like, Hannah would need to get to a point, ideally with, like, the help of therapy, to really be able to articulate, like, how much of her is her mm-hmm. and how much of her was like this persona that she feels like was created by Allison or by Mona or by anything else. So I think that Hannah would have to get pretty comfortable with saying, like, I know who I am, and this is it. So I think that that is some work that would have to happen on Hannah's part. I think that Hannah has already forgiven Mona for like being a, like,
oh, for sure.
Hannah forgives Mona, like, you know, like, and it's the idea of, like, what is forgiveness? Like, does it happen because someone deserves it? Does it happen because someone needs it? Like, Hannah's heart is a big blank check, and Hannah, like, she forgives Mona. So I think that, like, and she trusts Mona. Like, she tells Mona about the game. I think that, I think if anything, Mona would have to, like, work at, like, trusting Hannah, like, as weird as that sounds.
Yeah, no, I know what you mean.
I think that Mona would have to, like, trust that it wasn't, like, a trick, like, that, you know, that they could be together, that they could be happy, that they could, like, deserve each other.
I read this quote actually earlier today, so how appropriate, about forgiveness. It's a poem, and I don't have the author right handy, but it says, when I say I forgive you, know this. I did not bury the hatchet. I have the hatchet in my hands. I am building myself a new home. And I really like that a lot, and I like to think that Mona and Hannah sort of both have had to forgive each other for a lot of things and even perhaps still do. But I like the idea that sort of together they can build each other a new home. And it's sort of like they're always going to forgive one another. And I think that Mona or Hannah getting to a point where she can recognize the depth of what Mona means to her, not just the depth of what she means to Mona, like that would be the moment that it would really be able to happen.
And I think that Hannah needs to be able to, like, tell the other liars to fuck off if they give her any kind of attitude about it. Hannah needs to be able to, like, kind of stand in the spotlight and be like, this is what I want, this is what it means. If you love me, you're gonna get on board. And I think that the liars love her enough that they would get on board.
I think they would too. Yeah, if you love me, you have to figure out that you, and I think in their heart of hearts the liars could learn to love Mona. I really do.
I totally agree.
So I know we love Vandermeeren, but who else do you ship Mona with?
Okay, so I would say that my number two Mona ship is probably Mona Spencer. Just because their chemistry, is electric, and because we kind of see Mona, like, shift her focus to Spencer, you know, in the periods when Hannah is less available to her.
Yeah, I think so too. I like that. I like that a lot. I ship Mona with all of the liars. I'll just go on record and say, I think she and Arya are very interesting. I think she and Emily are very interesting. I also think Mona with Paige is super fascinating. You know, so much of the similar kind of rage and the similar experience of feeling really hurt by the liars. Mm-hmm. And then also Mona and Melissa, I think, is a fascinating combination.
Mona and Melissa, a sleeper pairing. But yeah, I do agree with that. Mona, Jenna.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Mona. Let's see. Who else? I mean, Mona.
You said all the liars, but, like, Mona Allison.
Oh, course. Mona Allison, for sure. For sure, Mona Allison. You know, I mean, hey, Mona Sarah Harvey, that would be a way to make Mona, to make Sarah Harvey more interesting.
I'll also say Mona Yvonne, because she was working for the campaign. Yeah. Yvonne is, like, sort of the less damaged version of Spencer.
For sure. God, you have done so much work for Yvonne as a character, just like making her more interesting.
It's true. I have given way more thought to her character than the show ever did. That is the fact.
That is absolutely true. That is absolutely true.
Yvonne deserved better. She did.
Yvonne absolutely deserved better. Yeah, I think Mona, speaking of characters who deserve better, Mona Shauna, there's something there. It was sort of both these queer women, mm-hmm. you know.
The A-team,
exactly. Yeah, who else?
Well, thinking along the lines of like queer characters who are like slightly outsiders, I would also say Mona Maya.
Oh, Mona Maya. Talk to me about Mona and Maya.
Well, okay, so I'm gonna say that they are, you know, they're both characters who exist in this space that is like adjacent to the Liars, but they're not 100%, like, you know, they're not 100% in with the group. Like Maya, there's sure. a whole period where Maya is like getting left in the hallway holding like a swimming sign while Emily and the Liars like rush off to do hijinks. So I feel like, you know, that would be a perfect moment for Mona to just be like, oh, I was here at the swim meet too. What would you like to go out to dinner? You know, I feel like they could kind of have a connection there, and they're both queer, and they both, like, you know, it kind of seems like they have parents who are not totally clued into what's going on with them. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I think that there could be some good connection there.
I like that a lot. Yeah, what else do you have? What are some other things that maybe you would think about for Mona's future?
Ooh, I mean, I
was just going to take a second to plug your fic, because you have a great fic that's like 13 futures for Mona Vanderwaal. Fabulous. Everyone should go read it. So sorry, go ahead.
No, I mean, I want Mona to have like, okay, there are two things. In that fic, like, a lot of the futures that I envision for Mona are, like, really big futures. Like, you know, she's on the Supreme Court. She's, you know, a Beyoncé-level pop star. She is, you know, like, mm-hmm. living these, you know, like, fabulous existences. But the other thing that I would equally want for Mona is... for her to just live like a totally basic, normal life. Like for her to like get Starbucks in the morning and like go on a Target run and just have like a, you know, just have, you know, have her life be like a series of like small moments that bring her like joy and success and like recovery from her addiction.
Yeah, I think that a quiet life, like, I think that Mona ultimately, she's probably going to go on to do something fabulous, you know, she's Mona, of course. But I think the idea of her getting at least a little bit of time, like, it was kind of implied that during the time jump, she got this of just like some time that was kind of calmer and more quiet. And her life was just like a little bit smaller and more regular. And I think that Mona can have that life and still be Mona. I don't think that she has to be full, you know, A mode, adrenalized hyperreality all the time, in order to be like her Mona self.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I agree with that. I also like the one thing that I really want for Mona is for the Liars to like accept her reformation. Because like at what point in the series do you feel like Mona was like the reformed version of Mona?
Yeah. It's a very good question. I think that Mona is, remember the scene when she pulls the knife out with the brain, you know?
Yes.
And she's like wielding the knife, and it's like she's kind of dressed in like sort of the it's like a very preppy version of Mona. And she's wielding that knife around. And I think that like, that is such a fascinating moment in terms of Mona's redemption, because like, we find out later, like, that was not something that she set up. That was actually mm-hmm. a Caleb and Paige set up to try to scare her. And so it's a genuine moment. And yet it sort of plays in this way where she's able to gain a lot of sympathy. And I think what's fascinating about Mona is, like, I think that it's all genuine in a sense. Like, whereas I think a character like, Jenna, for example, I think is often, you know, playing at being more innocent than she actually is and is, like, consciously playing that. I think Mona contains so many multitudes that it's sort of all real for her.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree with that. I think that Mona wants what is best for the Liars. Like, I think that is true. And that's true even when she's still working on the A-Team. Like, that's true even when she's on the ghost train trying to kiss Hannah. That's true even when, she's, like, kind of getting off on Spencer being traumatized by Toby, you know, breaking their anniversary plans. Like, I think that there is a significant part of Mona that she wants what's best. She wants what's best for the Liars, even if they don't always recognize what's best for themselves.
Yeah, I mean, she fixed the windshield, right?
Yeah.
That's such a glorious moment because it's Mona showing up when she doesn't necessarily have to. You know, she can't completely stay away.
She takes off that, like, she takes off that strange, like, elephantine mask and reveals herself in the red robes. Like, oh, yes, I'm on this. I've been blue snarfing Allie since she got back to town. And oh, my goodness, I can't believe that we left this off of the list of Mona quotes, but I need to know how it ends.
Yes. Yes. Well, and also Mona pulling off. The not entirely necessary moment when she pulls off the end of her stiletto to reveal that there's, like, a sharp, like knife at the bottom of it, even though it seems like her stiletto probably would have done the job just fine by itself.
Oh, my God. Yes. An amazing Mona moment for sure.
So good. And it's Mona, you know, she's only cryptic and Machiavellian because she cares.
Oh my goodness, that is so true. Yeah, so I also want to talk a little bit, not like a super lot, because I know it's not our favorite topic of conversation. So we get this ending for Mona that we are not huge fans of, but that's not really the end, because Mona goes on to the Perfectionists. So let us spend a little bit of time talking about, like, what are our thoughts about Mona's future as it exists in the world of the Perfectionists. I love the Mona Allison of it all. And again, like, the plausible deniability, I absolutely hate the Mona Mason of it all.
Jesus Mason. God damn it.
I had to look up that dude's name.
I was gonna be like, wow, you remembered that? So I think that the Perfectionists had this really interesting opportunity to sort of present this idea of, like, what if one of the Liars, specifically Allison, and what if it was just one of the Liars and Mona? What if one of the Liars was, like, removed from the Liar squad and sort of their only point of contact was Mona, and what relationship would form in the wake of that? And I think that what we saw is we saw a world where Mona actually got to be more understood because somebody else was, like, leaning on her, and she wasn't on the outside. She was inside the circle. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say that Mona also, like, when we talk about, like, Hannah is able to see, like, all of Mona, is able to see all of Allison in a way that very few other characters can.
And similarly, I felt that Allison was really able to see all of Mona in a way that other characters, particularly on the Perfectionists, you know, were not. Mm-hmm. the show was also doing an interesting thing where it was sort of implied that Mona knew some stuff that we didn't know, which feels very Mona. Again, it was all very, very vague. Remember when the, like, wasn't she like talking to a camera at one point?
Mirrors. She was always talking to mirrors. She was always talking to mirrors. Secretly cameras. Yes.
That's right. That's right. So I don't know. I mean, that show was so hellbent on not having Allison or Mona be queer in a way that seemed utterly bizarre to me, especially because it seemed so easy to set that up, either with Mona and Allie herself or Mona and that blonde woman who was the sister who was sort of...
Her name Taylor? I think the name is Taylor, yeah.
Which, I mean, you know, a queer Taylor, a queer blonde Taylor, imagine that. That show was such utter nonsense. Like, I don't really think we can come to any particular conclusion or, like, thesis statement about it, because it was just such a mess and such a mess of ideas. What do you feel?
Well, I did really like the Mona Allison relationship that formed, because I do feel like the thing that made it feel like Mona, like, I don't want to say that she was like in with the liars, but like a thing about any of the liars is that they've been through so much together that they can rely on one another, like, instinctively. And I like that Mona and Allison kind of built that relationship between themselves on The Perfectionists. That's one of the few things you'll ever hear me say that I liked about The Perfectionists. But I did like that. I did like that they came to rely on each other in that way.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think that's very well said, that it, like, it was always a questioned thing on PLL, but it did become second nature.
And that, like, Allison and Mona were two characters who everyone else always had a lot of distrust for. So to see them, like, developing that trust in each other, I thought was pretty rewarding. And even though, yes, The Perfectionist was like a hot pile of just garbage. I mean, there was that much there that was like super redeemable. But I do think that there was like a spark of an idea, like a seed that they just didn't really like grow very well. But it was in some ways a setup that could have been something we've always wanted. Like the liars trying to intervene to help another group of young people who are like being tormented to like, you know, overcome and escape that kind of situation.
Which, I mean, that's kind of what we were talking about, like with the Addison character, of like, this was an opportunity to do something that the show just seemed sort of bizarrely uninterested in exploring.
Right. And I can't really say that the characters on The Perfectionists were like, you know, super multidimensional, but even like the most one-dimensional character on The Perfectionists, who I think had to be, I'm not going to remember his name, the cello player,
the guy hated.
Dylan was the guy who got killed.
I think it was Dylan.
We'll have to look it up.
Are you the gay guy who didn't seem gay at all?
Yes, that guy.
You know what? I'm looking this up.
I don't think his name is Dylan, because I think that Dylan is the kid that got killed. I think that was Dylan. But TBD. Vina will look it up for us right now. But
okay, let's see.
Anyway, my point was that even the most one-dimensional character on the show, the music major who was like dreadful to watch, that that character was still more multidimensional than Addison.
Okay, so that was Dylan.
Oh, wow. Okay.
That was Dylan. Are you talking about the guy who got killed and was sort of the kickoff?
Yeah.
Oh, so that was Nolan.
Wait. Oh, Nolan. Nolan. Yes.
Another, okay. Dylan, Nolan, like they all sound the same. God, I can't believe that
I forgot that guy's name was Nolan, because it was so, like, we have Noel on PLL, and then we have this, like, dirtbag named Nolan. Yes. Anyway. So, yes, Dylan. Anyway, the point is that Dylan, who was, like, not a well-developed character at all, was still more multidimensional than Addison, in my opinion.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, by a slim margin, but sure. Oh my God, I'm just on the Wikipedia now. Do you remember how it started with like cello renditions of like Poker Face and Just Dance?
I do remember that.
Like, we were in a bad movie from like the early 2000s. Yeah.
I do. Yes.
Yeah. Oh man, what a terrible show. Also, the possibly gay seeming one was Taylor Hodgkins.
Yeah, I was pretty sure.
Yeah. God. Oh yeah, and then Sydney, that one girl who, or her name wasn't Sydney, the actress's name was Sydney. Caitlin, the one girl who had gay moms, but then the gay mom like had an affair with a man or something.
Oh. Wow, I had blocked that part out entirely. Yeah.
Totally fair.
It was quite a ride. I'm gonna say another positive thing about The Perfectionist.
Oh my
Shockingly,
God.
Shockingly. I know, I've said like two things that I liked about it. And now I'm gonna say a third. The third thing that I like about The Perfectionists is that even though it was a garbage mess, even though it did not have multidimensional characters, did have some new ideas. Like, The Perfectionists was not a show that just started with a bunch of new kids in a yard saying, "Where is this person? I think I heard her scream." Like, at least it was in a new setting. At least it had, like, it had some new situations.
Sure. It has some new situations.
Good situations, but they were novel situations.
Okay, they were novel situations. Now, can we get back to talking about Mona instead of The Perfectionist?
Yes, but Mona was on The Perfectionist.
Mona
was the lead of The Perfectionist.
Like, don't remind me.
I didn't just like do a backdoor pilot into talking about The Perfectionist. Like, this is relevant to like Mona's future.
It is. So what's your feeling on Mona post-perfectionist? Where's she going? Who's she with? What's happening? Oh,
well, I would love to say that she's with Allison.
I think
that, like, in the world of The Perfectionists, that would be the happily ever after.
I agree. I think based on The Perfectionist, it seemed like in a show where any of the decisions made sense, that was the decision this was heading towards.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would have liked that a lot.
I would have liked that as well. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, God, the thing with Mona, like you said, like, she's a character who could walk in saying anything. She's a character who, like, I would believe so many different futures for her.
Yeah, I agree. And, like, she's a character who, like, the thing about if she were to end up with Allison is like, the identity work that we've talked about, like, the show frequently kind of blames Allison for creating Mona, and then Mona created everything else. Like,
sure.
So I think the idea of like Mona and Allison finding redemption together, I like that as like a narrative ending.
Well, it reminds me of that scene. Do you remember the scene in season 6 when Allison is staying at her with her dad at that hotel, and they're having the toilet coffee?
She calls Mona,
and Mona comes to get her, and like they have this conversation where it's basically like Mona's Allison's like, I owe you so much. And it kind of sounds like she's going to end the sentence by like offering to go down on Mona. I think that that's like, I wish that that had been sort of the evolving conversation between their two characters as we had gotten into like season 6 and season 7.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree with that. Well, also you've heard me talk about like, this is a line and as a plot point that I love from Buffy, when the master says in Prophecy Girl, if you hadn't come, I couldn't go.
Like, yeah.
You took this step to try and avert your fate, but you've done the exact thing that is going to bring it to you. So I like that, like, Allison pretending like loser Mona was invisible is what, like, generates this hyper-adrenalized reality where Mona can be invisible. I like that plot line. And I also like the idea that, like, Allison and Mona can, like, create, like, huge unknown physical properties in the known world.
Yeah, I like that as well. It's like, you know, if those two would just team up, they could change everything.
Yes, you know? Exactly.
Yeah. Well, do we have anything more to say about our beloved Vander Jesus?
There's always more to say about the Vander Jesus, but I think that we have covered, I think we have covered as much as we can this evening without shifting into hyper-adrenalized reality ourselves.
Or accidentally turning back into talking about the perfectionist.
You are acting like I have done an unforgivable thing. Mona was all the perfectionist.
I know.
I'm sorry, but it is a fact.
She was on the perfectionist. I can't accuse you of doing something that off base. Yes. Yeah, I mean, I would love to hear from our listeners like any of your favorite Mona lines or Mona outfits. I mean, I think for me, like, my favorite Mona outfit would have to be black hoodie. Like,
ooh, it's a classic for a reason. I'm gonna go with glamping Mona. I loved the glamping Mona outfit. She's in like that camo mini skirt. She has like that hat. Oh my gosh,
it's an incredible look. Also, her shadow play look is amazing.
It is. It is. Her cashmere blends. I mean,
Her like when she goes. In No One Here Can Love or Understand Me, she has that like dress that she's wearing when she goes on like that disastrous date with Mike, and she just looks so pretty and sort of sweet and sad, and oh, she's so great.
She's perfect. She's Mona.
She's Mona. She's the Vander Jesus. She died for our sins. I can't believe I didn't include this, but another favorite moment of mine is like the moment when she really earns the Vander Jesus title when in taking this one to the grave, when it appears as though she has died and they replace the baby Jesus with the baby Mona. It's like such a perfect encapsulation of who this character is.
I can't believe that we've gone through this whole episode and talked about our favorite Monas and we did not mention zombie ghost haunting Mona.
Oh my
god. Torments Allie through the entirety of it. See, this is the whole thing. This is the whole thing about Mona. There's so much of her. You can never like capture it all in a bottle. But yeah, when I think about favorite looks, I do really like that kind of like post-apocalyptic zombie ghost Mad Max Mona look.
Jacob Marley kind of. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, so good. Yeah. I mean, she can pull it all off. It's incredible.
It's incredible. Absolutely incredible.
I love her. Well, if you have any thoughts on Mona, we want to hear from you. If you do, and how could you not? You can, of course, send us an email at everybodyapodcast@gmail.com. You can also check out our Instagram at everybodyapodcast. You can also check out our Spotify, Everybody A, Everybody Gay. You can also leave a rating and review on iTunes. We would appreciate it. Never fear, gentle listeners. We have a whole schedule of bonus episodes that will be coming up, which we are very excited about. We'll be talking about some men next week, some bad men. So, be prepared to hear us rant and rave a little bit.
Yes, we're going from is it the Ballad of Mona Vanderwall? Is that the mask of the face of the face on your face?
Yeah,
song,
by
Danny McCauley. We're going from that to the Pretty Little Men next week. So
yeah,
a musical connection there.
Absolutely. So until next time, make sure that you praise Vander Jesus, because she did indeed die for our sins.
Till next time.
Take care.